Everyone, this is a work session on the CARES Act and CAA for the Portland City Council. Who's kicking us off today?
Mayor, if you don't have any more opening remarks, I'm ready to go.
Good, you're off.
Okay. Good morning, Mayor Wheeler and City Council. My name is Tom Reinhardt. I'm proud to be the city's Chief Administrative Officer. And I am also very happy to be kicking off what we believe is the first work session of 2021 and with the new City Council. So welcome. We're going to focus today on the relief funding we received from the CARES Act, as well as discuss our recommendations on how we can and should prepare for additional federal funds. The work session today is broken into four parts. First, we will walk through the process in which we allocated and invested the $114 million in coronavirus relief funds. Second, the Office of Government Relations will provide us with an overview of recent state and federal legislation, which will bring much needed resources to the region. Third, in preparation for the Federal Emergency Rent Assistance Funds, the Housing Bureau will provide us with an updated status of our looming eviction crisis. And finally, we will outline some next steps in anticipation for the relief funds that are headed our way. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Jan Kim, who co-managed the CARES Act funds with Sheila Craig in our Grants Management Division. I've asked Jan to continue to oversee federal relief funds in the coming months and to work with all city leadership to allocate and direct funding. Jan. I think you're on mute, Jen.
You would think after all this time. Thank you. Good morning, Commissioner and Mayor. My name is Jian Kim, and I'm a Strategic Project Manager for the Office of Management and Finance. It is with distinct pleasure that I get to uplift the incredible work of our bureaus and the 100 plus program partners who work tirelessly to get the PDX CARES relief funds to Portland's most vulnerable. Before we get started, a little bit about format. We have a lot to cover today, and my hope is that during the first segment, the CARES Act presentation, you'll ask questions in the Zoom chat window. We have program staff in the gallery ready to answer your questions, and this will help us to keep moving through our ambitious agenda. During other segments of the work session, we have time for Q&A at the end of each presenter, and hopefully some time at the end for more discussion. As we conclude, Tom will summarize any next steps based on your direction. And lastly, I just want to take a moment to give a big shout out to the Bureau Directors, Grants Management and Procurement Teams, the City Attorney's Office, and all of the program managers, many of whom who were doing double duty delivering these programs while also conducting their regular jobs. And it's really strange to say that even though I haven't met most of these people, I really can't wait to give them a post-coronavirus hug when it's time. So just to get started, before we launch into the actual program reportouts, I wanted to quickly go through the city's decision-making process and allocation process for the benefit of our newly elected commissioners. To prepare for the arrival of the local relief funds back in April, the city took four actions. We first asked our bureau leadership to submit investment ideas that would help mitigate COVID-19's impact on our citywide operations and our community. We solicited feedback and recommendation from the Prosper Portland-led Economic Recovery Task Force. PBEM's Joint Volunteer Information Center listened to the needs of our most underserved populations through engaging with close to 100 community-based organizations. And lastly, we passed a recovery and resilience resolution, which put climate action equity at the center of our recovery. In addition, council directed that we form a local relief task force comprised of the chief administrative officer, a small team of bureau directors, and council executives to make recommendations on how to use these funds. As you can see here, you've probably seen this before, this is our final allocation. Note that this is still an active budget and some allocations may change as FEMA and other funding gets approved for reimbursement. But at the end of the day, over 100 million of the 114 received by the city went to support our community and our jurisdictional partners. And just another quick note, we won't be discussing jurisdictional partner support today. considering the recent CARES Act extension as part of the Federal Consolidated Appropriations Act, we've given our partners some additional time to disperse their funds. And so we're not going to know their precise allocations until a later date. And so with that, I'm going to pass the baton to Dr. Smith, who will discuss the OEHR Equity Toolkit.
Hey, good morning. Hopefully everyone can hear me okay. Glad to be here with you this morning. Just going to take a few minutes to examine the role the Office of Equity and Human Rights has had in this process. And from the very beginning, I have been a part of the small group of bureau directors that was coming together to really think about how we were going to center equity in the decisions that were being made for these funds, for the allocation of these funds. And so our role really has been to work in partnership with bureaus and with staff to really think about how we were centering our equity goals in our COVID response. When we had the adoption of the Relief and Recovery Resolution on May 20th of 2020, which included the adoption of our COVID-19 relief toolkit, we had some authority given to us as an office to really monitor what the implementation of that look like. And then finally, as we're doing here today, and we've done in some previous meetings, sort of sharing updates around what's been happening as it relates to the toolkit and its use in our COVID-19 efforts. Okay, next slide, please. So the goals of the toolkit really were, there like four bullets here that I'll share, really to, we've had a lot of good work around our values and our commitments and sort of our legal obligations as it relates to City of Portland. And so really the toolkit reemphasized that and gave sort of an overview of where we've been and how what we are doing currently really feeds into that. The other thing that I really like about the toolkit is that it identified populations that were most in need based on what was happening or what has been happening with COVID. And so in partnership with our county counterparts, we were able to include some information from the dashboard that really sort of broke down this data and is, you know, ever changing, but really gave us a strong foundation in thinking about what populations we needed to identify and needed to make sure that we were focused on in these efforts. Okay, next slide. And then the final two things that I'll share is that the toolkit also was really developed to encourage what was happening at the ECC and within bureaus to really think about the goals and, you know, whether they were equity focused. You know, thinking about our performance measures as a city, and not just for COVID-19 response, which is sort of where we are now, but really beyond that, right? So there are components to this toolkit that really can serve us well once we get past this period in time. And then finally, the toolkit also provided some information, resources, easy access to tools and some technical assistance to think about how to really prioritize the work of equity as we were making our decisions and thinking about our strategy. And so there are, you know, a plethora of resources that are available in the toolkit that have been useful for this effort. And I would say just in various other efforts that have been happening citywide. And it's been my privilege to be a part of this process. And I look forward to continuing to partner in the work that we're doing. And I will stop. And I think I'm going to turn it over to, yes, Jeff.
Hi, good morning, Mayor Wheeler and commissioners. My name is Jeff Hawthorne, and it's really an honor to be presenting to you today as the city's new arts program manager. I'm taking the reins from my predecessor and my friend, Jian Kim, who helped design many of the programs that I'm about to talk about, but is now doing all of this important work with CARES and the emergency response for the city. So thank you, Jian. In this slide, you can see that the city invested $4.35 million in its arts and culture community. And that includes $1.6 million for the Portland 5 Centers for the Arts and $2.5 million for other arts and entertainment venues across the city of Portland, both privately owned businesses and nonprofit organizations. And these funds were distributed through a great partnership between Prosper Portland and the Regional Arts and Culture Council, and they played a vital role rounding out the support that the state had provided earlier in the year, but many of our local venues had previously been left out of that process. Also, you'll see in this slide, on the right-hand side, that the city arts program also worked with RAC and Portland Parks and Recreation to distribute $250,000 in cash support for artists who identify as Black, Indigenous, and people of color by purchasing their artwork and funding their artistic projects, many of which were in direct response to the global pandemic and the fight for social justice. So let's, on the next slide, we can look a little bit more at the venues that we were able to support. 99 venues in all throughout the city of Portland, including the five theaters that make up P5. 55 small businesses like Darcel's in Old Town and Tango Baratine on Southwest Foster Road. And 39 profit organizations like the Headwaters Theater in Northeast Portland and Vibe of Portland in St. John's. Across the country, live music and performance venues have been among the hardest hit businesses. And we are pleased to report that 40% of the funding that was distributed by RAC and Prosper Portland went to BIPOC-owned or operated venues. One venue, I want to share a comment, which was really a common sentiment, the idea that the PDX CARES grant, quote, has been our lifeline, helping us negotiate terms with the building owner that will allow us to remain tenancy until the pandemic is brought under control, end quote. And then you'll recall that $1.6 million went to P5. These are the five theaters that really serve as the backbone of our region's performing arts industry. They host over 1,000 performances in a typical year and generate over $80 million in visitor spending. They typically rely on the events and event-related revenue for 80% of their operating budget. And because they're publicly owned, they weren't really eligible for the direct federal aid that was in the CARES Act. So even without any performances in its theaters and reducing its staff by over 75%, these buildings still have operating costs of about $500,000 a month. And so earlier in the year, Portland 5 received about $1 million in state CARES funding, and Metro is providing another $150,000 per month in financial assistance, but that's just not enough. So in November, the City Council approved up to an additional $1.6 million in emergency operating assistance from the general fund. And our hope is that this funding, along with additional funding that the organization is able to realize from the new December relief federal bill, will be enough to help the organization sustain until revenues begin to return because events can be produced. And in fact, we're hopeful that all of these theaters will be able to start resuming programs in their spaces and earning revenue by late summer. But if the closure period extends much beyond that, additional resources may be needed. And then one last slide, just to talk about the money that went directly to artists. Portland Parks and Recreation collaborated with the city's creative laureate, Sebastian A. Ganason, to sponsor socially distant performances at lunch and play sites across the city of Portland this past summer. And they also curated dozens of videos from artists who were performing outdoors and capturing their performances on video. So in the months ahead, Parks will be posting these videos on their landing page for their Stay and Play series. And we're also talking with the Creative Laureate and other city leaders about ways that we can celebrate and distribute these videos in the future. And at the same time, RAC was sending out the call to diversify the representation, artistic disciplines, and points of view in the city's public art collection. They ended up purchasing more than 50 new visual artworks, as well as other art in other disciplines like film and music videos through a program called Capturing the Moment. And so these artworks that the city has now purchased will forever document the year we just went through together, and they provided direct support for artists in need. RAC also provided cash grants of $3,000 to $5,000 to support another 16 emerging BIPOC artists. So I'm pleased to report that the city and all of our partners got all of the money out the door, and these grants are having a significant impact on preserving and sustaining our arts and culture community, sustaining them through a crisis until venues can safely reopen and artists can have opportunities to work. We were able to focus significant efforts on supporting Black, Indigenous, and people of color and BIPOC-owned and operated venues in our community. And we purchased artwork and performance videos and literature from artists who are helping us mark this important moment in time and help us process our collective struggles and aspirations with candor and creativity. Just looking ahead for a moment, we know that we need to maintain our investments in arts and culture, including our support of RAC. We need to support artists and arts organizations at a time when collections for the arts education and income education income tax are down. And we need to help artists navigate these complex federal funding programs. If there is another round of federal relief, we hope we can help demystify the process and simplify our application processes even further. And then lastly, we remain optimistic that we'll be able to launch a comprehensive planning process this fall that will help us identify the community's priorities for arts and culture and do a better job of aligning all of our arts-related investments with other city priorities, including economic recovery, neighborhood livability, and of course, the equitable distribution of resources. So thank you for your support of the creative community. We appreciate it.
Jeff, thank you, and great presentation and welcome. We're all excited for you and the energy that you bring to this position. So congratulations. I had a couple of questions, and they intersect well with what you've just been describing. You describe it as capturing the moment. There was really a tremendous amount of extraordinary artwork done on the panels on buildings. And I know that there are plans for many of that artwork to be retained and preserved. It's of both artistic as well as historical significance. And I'm pleased to see that the efforts the city is undertaking with other nonprofit and arts institutions throughout the city to help make that a reality. But I'd also like us to think more about that intersection that you mentioned between arts and neighborhood livability. And in particular, an area that I have interest in is ascertaining whether there are areas in public right-of-ways that are frequently tagged by graffiti and for which various government jurisdictions, including the city of Portland, are spending a lot of money to continually remediate. Could we put art in some of those spaces instead? Street murals, in other words. Is there a way for us to step up our ongoing activities with some of our community partners to do that? And just to give you sort of one example out of an entire city of opportunity, the interchange at I-405 in Gleason is a great big cement wall at the overpass of Gleason Street as it goes over I-405. It's regularly tagged, it's regularly cleaned pretty much on a weekly basis. But it could be an extraordinary place for us to document Portland's history and document not only the BLM movement and the time that we find ourselves in, but also inspire people and give people hope for what our future could look like here in the city of Portland. And I'd like us to be more intentional in exploring that. So that's sort of my first thing. And Commissioner Rubio, that will be in the letter that will be coming to you today regarding your Bureau assignments to work with me and others on the council to explore that possibility. The second question I have is a longer term question. And while I certainly support the idea of the city of Portland directly supporting artists and directly investing in their artwork, I've always been somewhat sad that some of the best artwork purchased through this program ends up in private auction. And that seems kind of wrong to me on some level. While I appreciate we're supporting, it doesn't seem right that the public doesn't benefit from those investments in the art and the art collection we make. So I feel like there needs to be some commitment that in some way, somehow, some place, some time, those artworks are in fact displayed publicly for the benefit of the public who pays for it all. So I'm not asking you for any answers today. I just want you to know that those are things that have been on my mind. And since you happen to be here in front of the council, I thought I would take that opportunity just to raise those issues with you, because those will continue to be front and center from my perspective. And last but not least, and I realize the focus of your presentation right here and right now is one thing. I would like to see Native art in our community highlighted more than it currently is. And I look at the work that both Seattle and Vancouver, British Columbia have done to really elevate and highlight the Native art in their communities, and they've even made it more of a public brand of what those communities are. I wish we did that too, because I feel like we're missing out on some education and cultural opportunities when we don't elevate and lift local Native artists to the degree that I see other cities doing. So I actually threw in an extra. That's three areas that I just want you to think about in your new position.
Thank you, Mayor Wheeler. And I know our friends at RAC are watching and listening to this conversation, and so we'll continue to talk about those things that you just
brought. I was absolutely hoping that they were. Thank you. Great.
All right, Katie, let's go on to you.
Okay, thanks so much, Jeanne. And thank you, Mayor, for, I liked your last point about more Native art in Portland. I fully agree. All right, well, I'm Katie Wolf. I'm the operations manager for the Bureau of Emergency Management. I serve as our Emergency Coordination Center manager and one of the incident commanders for the city's COVID response. The city's ECC has been activated since March to respond to the health and economic emergency created by COVID-19. It's staffed by about 80 people who come from many different bureaus. About 65% of that team works full-time. So thank you to the bureaus and offices who have kindly lent us their staff to this important work. Our main goal is to wrap around services that fill around some of the enormous need in the community. So we're not public health, and so we can't directly address the COVID-19 response, but we can still provide assistance to underserved communities in the form of PPE, food, household supplies, and cash assistance. The ECC does use a racial and disability equity lens in all response efforts. We believe that targeted investments in community-based organizations grows our overall community resilience. We don't want to offer a one-time community or a one-time government band-aid. So we will need council direction on where the future of our relief efforts should go after the ECC demobilizes and how long they want the ECC to remain activated. We do have about $2.3 million of current fiscal year incident budget to use to continue these relief programs. We've already used up all of our CARES money last year, so that's what we have left over. I want to mention that we also have a six-month progress report, which goes into a lot more detail than I can cover today, with lessons learned and recommendations, and I'll share that again with council offices. We do get the question a lot about how long we'll stay activated for, so I just wanted to touch on that. As long as we're in a federal state of emergency, we can receive FEMA funds to reimburse us at 75% of our eligible projects, our eligible costs. So that's a good milestone marker. That emergency may extend into next year. We don't know. We really don't know yet what our vaccination timetable is going to be, or even if we'll ever be able to achieve herd immunity. A state expert recently said that if we vaccinate 90% of our adults, we can reach 70% herd immunity. But Dr. Fauci has stated that we need to reach for at least 85% herd immunity. So, children under 19 have not been approved for any vaccines. So right now we're kind of in a fuzzy period where we don't know when we can go back to school. We don't know how long we'll be stuck in response mode. We don't know how long recovery might take. So that said, we're just gonna keep doing what we've been doing. This is all listed on the slide here. We can go to the next slide. Looking at what's next for our work in 2021, obviously the topic on everyone's mind is vaccine planning, and we are getting into the weeds on this on several levels. We just don't have time to cover all of that here. We can talk about that more in other settings. We're working closely with our county and regional partners to support their efforts while also making plans to be ready to offer our staff vaccine as soon as it's available. But for the ECC, we are examining our program models. We are taking feedback from our served communities and making improvements. For example, we're transitioning away from providing household supplies and wholly to providing cash assistance cards and distributing them in the most equitable manner possible. When we talk about how long the ECC is going to be around, our sustainability and our transition planning, we definitely need to have some more conversations on these topics. For one thing, if we want the ECC to be active all of this year, we need to staff it sustainably. Staff turnover is extremely disruptive. We are now covering the ECC staff salaries on bureau budgets. We were covering them on CARES until the end of last year. So they've returned to being covered by bureau budgets. If a staff person becomes unbudgeted, or if they are unbudgeted, such as laid off staff, we are able to cover their costs as a FEMA reimbursement. So again, only up to 75%. Again, if we want ECC active all year, we would like council direction on priorities. And we also need to think about transitioning projects and programs into bureaus or standing them down. So with my time, I think that's what I wanted to cover, and to go into more detail on our projects that serve people facing homelessness, I'll hand it over to Zach Curl from the mayor's office.
Before you do that, Katie, question. So the council has made, and therefore the city has made, available resources to the state to help with vaccination. We have offered our first responders as well as other resources. In addition, we've advocated for the standard to be reduced for the vaccination to allow EMT basics to be able to administer the vaccination. There's no reason to believe that EMT basics could not safely and professionally administer those vaccinations. The state is behind on its vaccination strategy. What has been the response from the state to our offer of assistance?
I don't have that information to provide to you right now, Mayor. I can certainly follow up on that. I think that the county and the state are having conversations to increase the amount of vaccine administrators, including volunteers that are medical professionals, part of the SERVOR program that should be used for exactly this thing. But there's a bigger conversation around liability and coverage that the state has been shying away from for many years. We've definitely ran into this with our own NET program. We have our own huge pool of volunteers. So it's the same issue that's just come up again. We absolutely need government relations to help us continue to lobby for these kinds of common sense solutions that were put in place for exactly this reason. We've been preparing for emergencies like this for years, and there's no reason we should be sitting on that right now. We need those people to join us to get through this backlog. We're absolutely behind. So we can follow up on that some more.
Yep. All right. Mayor, thinking with our EMTs, they're used to saving people's lives on a daily basis. I'm sure they can give people a shot of vaccination. Mike, were you going to chime in?
Sure, Mayor. This is Director Myers, for the record. You raise a great question, and I think you and I have discussed the sense of urgency around vaccinating just not our own employees, but the general public and getting out front. This is a national issue, and if you scan across the news, it is clear that vaccine rollout from the nation to the states has been harbored. It is not moving at the pace necessary to achieve success. In my discussions with the state, they tell me they are not holding on to vaccine, that they have pushed out what they have. That means it is sitting in the counties and the cities to do the vaccine. And I believe we are achieving good progress. And Portland Fire has been, I think, the gold standard of that. When they receive vaccine, they deliver it. And you've got a lot of good partners in that with OHSU and some of the hospitals doing their appropriate vaccine. Two things come to mind, Mayor, that I think we need to have discussions, and really this is in concert with you and your county partners, who have been on the same page as you, Mayor, with a sense of urgency around this. They've been having, my understanding, a strong discussion with the state about the need to move more vaccine. And I think the two issues are, one, you just talked about it, the city has an army of people that can assist. I believe we should assist. I know we're not the public health entity here, but the bottom line is this is our city. We have a vested interest in protecting the public, and we have an interest in doing that with Chief Boone and her staff. And I think that that can be achieved with the right amount of council and the state's willingness to move. And then I think there's a second area that I think we can work on, and that is to continue to push for more vaccine to be moved quicker to the city. And that is going to be, I think the state may be interested in that as well. So working with government relations, your authority the county chair's authority, and whatever common goal we can get with the state. If we don't pull this off, and this is right at every headline on every news agency right now, if we don't pull this off and start vaccinating more, there's no way, Mayor, we're getting to economic recovery that we are interested in, because we're going to continue to have to face quarantines and repeated outbreaks. And I'll continue to caution this group, and I've done this since March. The longer we wait, the more more COVID-19 that circulates through the population, the more passes it makes through the population, the more variants we will see. The more variants of COVID that we see, the more opportunity for mutation that we see, and the more mutation that we see, the larger the likelihood that we will have a mutation somewhere around the world that these current vaccines will not work. And we have to race against time. So we need all of your authority. We need all of the government relations power and your cooperation with the county and the state to push the Biden administration to roll this out. And then we need to be ready to deliver it.
Yeah, good. And thank you for that summary. And we should talk offline, because there is a letter that is starting to circulate amongst mayors of large jurisdictions nationally. I have been asked whether I would like to sign on. The gist of it is that supplies, or some percentage of supplies, would go directly to municipal governments that have EMT capacity. So I'd love your advice on that.
Mayor, can I make a suggestion? We have a full discussion scheduled for our Disaster Policy Council on this. I knew when I saw this bullet point on Katie's slides, we could spend a lot of time on this. Yes, we need to talk about this, but I want to assure you, we have a whole list of things to discuss with that entire committee, including you, Mr. Mayor, around these issues.
I'll look forward to it. And can we please make sure that GR is on that call as well?
Of course.
Good. Thank you. Sorry for the diversion, but it's a really important point. The city has something to offer here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mayor. And thank you for Katie to give me some opportunity to talk about our emergency efforts to provide resources for people experiencing homelessness in our community during this pandemic. So since the beginning, we have been working to leverage CARES dollars to provide essential services and investing some of those into capital assets that we can use long before after the end of the COVID emergency. So in April, Mayor's office and Commissioner Hardesty's office worked with a coalition of homeless advocates and service providers to create 3 temporary outdoor emergency shelters. This is called the Creating Conscious Communities with People Outside, or C3PO. And we prioritized these spaces for individuals who are in the BIPOC or LGBTQ+ communities, who we know are disproportionately experiencing homelessness in our community. The locations of these 3 sites are on Prosper Portland properties. The one image that you see in that slide is at Northwest 6th and Gleason in Old Town. And we also have 2 sites in Central East Side at Southeast Water and Main. They're currently 100 pallet sleeping pods. These are aluminum structures. We have hooked them up with electric heaters so they can be a year-round resource. Right to Dream 2 is the principal service provider for these camps. Each camp has paid staff to help manage the safety and overall well-being of participants. And my team has also been involved in coordinating meals, which is provided by community partners. And we are also managing contracts that provide hygiene access, including showers and laundry facilities. Over the summer, we also began permitting and identifying contractors for the construction of a permanent outdoor shelter called St. John's Village, obviously in St. John's. There are 19 sleeping pods in this village. It's going to be operated by Do Good Multnomah, and we're anticipating that it will be opening sometime next month. And then third, we also have been responding to the closure of many public amenities since the pandemic began, by deploying hygiene facilities in areas that have an absence of public bathroom access. And so Hucker conducted an audit back during the summer to identify and locate more than 120 portable toilets. And we've worked with Portland Parks to add some 80 additional portable toilets to allow for 24/7 access year round, which is an important quality to that. If you can go to the next slide. So some of the lessons we've learned through the project at our C3PO outdoor emergency shelters, it's really been a pilot in many ways for operating a temporary outdoor shelter and running it through the city. So it has given us a lot of experience in that and an opportunity to also uplift Right to Dream 2, who's been a resource in our community for many, many years, running their rest area in the Motor Center area. We have also seen the potential for many community partnerships and support through the city. Community groups and volunteers have been a really vital resource in developing St. John's Village, but also in providing essential services at C3PO. And I think I also want to make sure that we, the HUCRP has also been doing audits since they have placed their hygiene facilities, and we've learned a lot from that, that really it's not just individuals living outside, but these outdoor, or excuse me, these hygiene facilities, these portable toilets are really being used by everybody in the community, and it has shown a pretty immense need for adequate hygiene access and areas across the city. What's next? The city's going to be extending its contract. And in fact, I think since I've added this bullet point, we have executed an amendment to extend the contract with Right to Dream 2 to be our shelter operator through the end of fiscal year 2021. We are going to, what we learned from the bathroom audit is that there's a need for ADA accessible bathrooms. And so we're going to be increasing the number of ADA portable toilets throughout the city. And this last bullet point is just recognizing the kind of overstretched shelter operators with the COVID-19 physical distancing requirements. We have expected labor shortages, and in the event of a severe weather warming shelter, the county has reached out to the city to see if we can help in staffing these. And so Katie Wolf has just done a tremendous job to add trainings for city staff that relate to COVID-19 safety precautions and identifying ways that we can incentivize city staff in working these shifts.
Thank you, Zach.
Great. Good morning. I'm Andrea Durbin, the Director of Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and we manage two CARES Act projects, which I will share with you briefly. First, the first project was administering $5 million to address the digital divide. Before I describe the effort, I'd like to thank our many partners in this work, the Office of Community Technology, the Office of Equity and Human Rights, and several of our partners that co-led this work with us, including Multnomah County, SUMA, Coalition of Communities of Color, and Creative Emergent Technology Institute. And I'd like to thank Christine Kendrick on the BPS team who managed this work for us. And actually, Jian, we're on the wrong slide. Oh, there we go. We know that the pandemic increased the dependence on technology and exposed the growing digital divide in our community, especially for the BIPOC and disability community. Based on a 2018 survey, we understood that 32,000 households in Portland are not connected to the internet. These are households that earn less than $75,000 a year, and half of them make less than $20,000 annually. And based on the demand for this project, we think that those numbers may be higher. Next slide. BPS worked closely with our local government and community partners to distribute $5 million directly to meet these needs for frontline communities. We provided 3,500 Chromebooks, nearly 8,500 internet assistance cards, and culturally appropriate digital training resources to BIPOC community members and individuals with disabilities. We also distributed 547 iPads and protective cases as assistive devices to individuals with disabilities. Next slide. 113 community organizations applied for support. We worked with these 24 community partners to distribute resources directly to the community members that they serve. Next slide. And even with significant support, we have only started to meet the needs in our community. You can see that we only met the demand for about 17% of the Chromebooks requested, 10% of the iPads requested, and 36% of the internet access cards requested. Next slide. We learned some important lessons from this project, including leadership of frontline communities in the design and implementation is critical and enabled us to deliver services more broadly in the community. Engagement of those most impacted and organizations connected to impacted communities takes resources and time. And affordable and reliable broadband internet is not a luxury, it's a basic utility that should be available to all. I'd like, on behalf of the Digital Divide project team, we want to thank City Council for identifying the Digital Divide as a critical need and prioritizing investing these resources directly for frontline communities. And then I'll switch to the next slide and I'll share the second project we managed. Was called the App-Based Community Care Project. The goal of this project was to connect BIPOC elders, people with disabilities, caregivers, and youth to programs and services available during the pandemic that address well-being, social isolation, and safety. This project focused on outreach to the Somali community, the largest African ancestry subgroup in Multnomah County, by providing information about services available during the pandemic and PPE supplies. BPS worked with Care Wheels, a local technology nonprofit, to understand experiences of isolation and the use of technology across ages, cultures, and disability groups. We helped test a phone and computer-based app intended to serve people across ages and cultures, as well as people with varying abilities. Care Wheels is now using the information to update its CareBank app to offer peer-to-peer care to connect and support elders, caregivers, people with disabilities, and others in the community. Specific outcomes of this project included better understanding of COVID-19 experiences of BIPOC communities, including issues of isolation, misinformation, and growing mental health concerns within the community. We co-designed the project with the Somali community to provide culturally relevant information and referrals of COVID-19 programs and services to vulnerable community members. PPE was offered to all project participants and community engagement support in the form of gift cards, and six of the seven vendors were BIPOC community members. And Care Wheels, a local 501c3 nonprofit, is using information from the project to improve their app, which will be tailored to meet the needs of BIPOC and disability communities. While this project was much smaller by comparison, it was $50,000, it helped us test ways to provide culturally appropriate information to members of the community, particularly the Somali immigrant community, to make sure that they are informed and empowered to protect themselves during the pandemic. I'd like to thank the Disabled Refugee Alliance, the Somali Empowerment Circle, Multnomah County's REACH program, OEHR, and the ECC for their support, partnership, and guidance on this project. I'd like to specifically thank and appreciate Alan De La Torre, who leads the age-friendly work pilot for the city, for his leadership and hard work on this project as well. And both project managers, Christine Kendrick and Alan De La Torre, are with us today if you have any specific questions that they can answer. But we want to just conclude by thanking you very much for your support for these two innovative projects.
All right, Director Warner.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you so much. For the record, Chris Warner, Director of the Portland Bureau of Transportation. I want to thank you for the opportunity to highlight how PBOT used their CARES Act funding to support Portland's pandemic response. We funded two initiatives with our allocation. First, we launched an innovative COVID-19 health safety campaign in partnership with Multnomah County Public Health. And secondly, we deployed funding to support businesses participating in our healthy business program. COVID-19 pandemic, as you know, has been devastating both here in Portland and across the country. Unfortunately, as our city's equity toolkit with COVID response predicted, the pandemic has hit some populations, including Black and Latinx communities, harder because of existing inequities. Following the philosophy of Ubuntu, which translates into humanity towards others, we designed a public campaign that takes these disparities to heart. The campaign urges Portlanders to stay COVID safe and be Portland strong for the sake of their loved ones, their communities, and our city. The message campaign was developed, produced, and marketed by Blackballed Films, a local COVID certified emerging production company. Next slide, please. The centerpiece of the campaign are three public service announcements that are currently being broadcast on local TV, including Univision. The links to these videos are put into the chat. Mi Abuela has been translated into Spanish, and voiceover translations are available to community groups upon request. The campaign's second key element is COVID Safe Portland Strong Pledge, which we are urging all Portlanders to take. The pledge has been translated into 7 languages in order to extend the campaign's reach as widely as possible. In addition to our general public distribution plans, these communication tools are being made available to community partners as they work to support their networks during the pandemic. Next slide. In addition, we have also taken advantage of partnerships to amplify the campaign's central messages. Working with the Portland Art Museum, we purchased billboards highlighting the work of Carrie Mae Weems. A Portland native, Weems has created a health-focused public art project called Resist COVID, Take 6. We're also working with local organizations like the Trailblazers and the Timbers to help the campaign reach new audiences, especially young people. This is only the second time that PBOT has undertaken a public messaging campaign of this size and scope, and this is the first time we've specifically focused on communities of color in this way. We're grateful for the support of the City Council and the CARES Act in helping us live up to our racial equity commitments and make Portland a healthier, safer city. Next slide, please. We've also used our second allocation of CARES Act funding to support participants in our Healthy Businesses program. The program was part of our Safe Streets initiative, which we launched this past summer. The Healthy Business program has supported the safer operation of local businesses by allowing dining, retail, and other business activities on the streets and the sidewalks. The Healthy Business program was adapted this summer to winter weather conditions. The program has succeeded beyond all expectations. Over 800 businesses participated this summer, and over 250 are participating in the Winter Healthy Business program, including over 75 BIPOC businesses. Next slide. To help these businesses, we are providing direct aid to them to pay for materials and resources to winterize their outdoor spaces with such things as canopies and heaters. Businesses have received an average of about $1,500 to meet these needs. Next slide. And we also use a portion of the funds to buy supplies that we will use to support businesses who want to operate outdoors starting in spring. The plaza kits we purchased will be distributed to our community partners, and they will focus on supporting BIPOC-owned businesses and businesses in East Portland. The Healthy Business Program has been instrumental in allowing local shops and restaurants to weather the pandemic. We've heard from many establishments that thanks to the city support, they're able to retain and even add jobs during the city's because of the city's flexible and creative approach. We're very proud of the small role that we've played in helping these local institutions. And that ends my presentation, and I can answer any questions.
Thank you, Chris.
Yep, thank you.
Good morning, Mayor Wheeler and commissioners. For the record, I'm Kimberly Branham, Executive Director at Prosper Portland. And it's my pleasure to be here today to talk about the Small Business Relief Fund. City Council allocated $15 million to Prosper Portland to distribute small business resources, and grants were available up to $25,000 to businesses that experienced a significant decline in revenue, had $5 million or less in annual revenue, and had 50 or fewer employees. Understanding the racial disparities and the economic shock following our public health crisis, as well as the inequitable access that we saw to federal funds, such as the PPP program, and with input from the Economic Recovery Task Force and the Small Business Relief Fund Selection Committee, we applied a racial equity and vulnerability lens to the selection and engagement process, and we prioritized investments in businesses for whom either the resources would help keep them operational, the businesses were providing childcare services, the businesses were intending to use the resources to adapt to their new COVID-19 environment, or businesses that had not received significant federal funds. Working with community partners and community development financial institutions, I'm very pleased to share that we have been able to select and disperse the funds in line with the aggressive timeline. Next slide, please, Jen. So netting out administrative investments, over $11 million in grant funds were available directly through the process that Prosper Portland ran with our selection committee, and nearly $3 million were available as block grants to community partners that were able to reach culturally specific populations to provide access to these funds. Prosper Portland received 5,040 applications, and we selected 928 businesses to receive the funds. And there are an additional 423 businesses that received support through block grant partners. The map here shows the geographic distribution of the 1,350 businesses total. You'll see that about 24% of the businesses are in North and Northeast Portland, about 26% in East Portland, and about 20% in the Central City. So we saw pretty even geographic distribution. And in line with the identified priorities, approximately 89% of grants were awarded to businesses owned by people who identify as Black, Indigenous, and people of color, with the breakdown detailed in the graph. And 57% of grants were awarded to women-owned businesses. There was a wide range of industry representation with businesses from retailers to caterers, gyms to hotels, but about 60% of the resources went to restaurants, personal services, or childcare providers. And these are industries that have been very hard hit or, like childcare, are really essential to the functioning of the rest of our economy. Next slide, please. As you might recall, the CARES supported Small Business Relief Fund grants were actually the third round of small business relief funds following the public health crisis. And so we were able to apply several lessons learned from previous rounds. We've highlighted on this slide five lessons that enabled the team to disperse the significant resources in record time and in line with our strategic priorities. So the first is that involving the selection committee early and often improved the program design, was critical to developing criteria and enabled a smooth selection process. The second was that council's clear direction to focus on supporting businesses strategically instead of taking a first come, first serve approach enabled a holistic review process and the outcomes that I touched on. The third is that we learned how essential it is to use multiple communication channels. So that included website and social media pushes, but also getting the message out through culturally specific organizations through their networks, as well as having a staffed hotline to answer questions. And we use snail mail, direct mailers, to help to address the digital divide. We translated into multiple languages, and this really helped us to reach a broader swath of businesses. The fourth is that the additional $15 million and the increase from a maximum of $10,000 to $25,000 as the highest grant level made a significant difference. We have heard from countless businesses that without these resources, they would be closed or they would have had to lay off even more staff. However, we also know that the need is enormous, and we are hopeful that there will be future rounds of funding because there were way too many businesses that we were not able to support. And the fifth is that we simply would not have been able to meet the timelines or serve the diversity of businesses without the strong and existing equity-focused networks from the Inclusive Business Resource Network, the culturally specific Chambers of Commerce, our Neighborhood Prosperity Initiative districts, and some key new partnerships. The ability to cover their administrative costs was essential for these organizations to be able to do this work, especially as private fundraising has dried up. These are really critical resources to support the ongoing capacity of these organizations, and that will continue to be true in the months and years ahead. So finally, our partners are highlighted on the panel on the right here. And I just want to close by appreciating deeply each of them, as well as the entire Prosper team, for their incredible dedication, for their creativity, and for their collaboration. We also want to thank City Council, GN, and the OMF team, the Office of Equity and Human Rights, the Selection Committee, the Economic Recovery Task Force, RAC, and PBOT, all for your invaluable leadership and your partnership. We really look forward to continuing to find ways to support small businesses that are so critical to the fabric of our city and employment in Portland in the months and years ahead. Thank you.
Thanks, Kimberly.
Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. For the record, I'm Matthew Schaubel, the Policy and Planning Manager with the Portland Housing Bureau. And I'm here to talk about our COVID housing assistance programs. Next slide, please. So before I get started, I just want to acknowledge the magnitude of our programming that we've put out in the last 6 months.
In total, above and beyond the local government relief funds, we've put over $50 million of services into the communities. And for most of this money, we've been standing up new programs and implementing them in a remote work environment. I want to acknowledge the Housing Bureau staff. I want to acknowledge the staff of our partners, Home Forward, the department, the Multnomah County Department of County Human Services, the Joint Office of Homeless Services, as well as all of our community-based partners. And while it may be an abuse of the Zoom chat, I have listed all of them in the chat because there are too many to fit on a slide. And we could not have done this work without all of our partners who have all come together in these times to get these services out the door on top of the services that they're already providing on an annual basis. So at the beginning of the crisis, the Housing Bureau convened four task forces in order to determine what was the best way for the city to proceed in responding to the crisis should resources become available. We had the task force focused on the rental housing market stabilization and supporting affordable homeowners, in supporting affordable rental housing development, and supporting existing affordable housing, regulated affordable housing buildings. And those four task forces had participants from the community, from City Hall, from our partner agencies and our partner jurisdictions, and each developed a framework for the necessary services in order to support vulnerable Portlanders as we responded to the COVID crisis. And that framework, which was grounded on the racial equity toolkit developed by OEHR, helped to inform the programs that we eventually implemented when City Council allocated some of the local government relief funds. So when looking at the Renter Stabilization Program, the Renter Stabilization Program was designed to serve households at 80% of the median income and below. This is a joint program with the Joint Office of Homeless Services, Home Forward, the Housing Authority in Multnomah County, and the County Human Services. There are multiple funding sources in this program. It was $25 million, and it included both city CARES as well as state CARES that was passed to the county. And we worked with over 44 community-based organizations in order to prioritize BIPOC renters and people experiencing disabilities. While we're still collecting the data and compiling the data from all of the people who applied and who have received assistance, we're roughly 58% of the way through collecting all of the reports. So far, the outcomes are good. We've served 76% of renters supported are from BIPOC communities, and the average assistance is $3,800. One other note, we had a smaller, less well-known program that I just want to acknowledge, and it was using other federal funds, and it was around $4.5 million of home funds. And this was a rental assistance program designed to support residents living in regulated affordable housing. And home funds are a little bit more complicated to administer, which is why we decided to use those with our affordable housing partners across the city. The Housing Bureau regulates over 14,000 rental units in the city of Portland. And so we wanted to support those renters because we knew that they were experiencing the economic crisis most acutely. And so we prioritized renters with incomes below 60% of the median income for those resources. And we prioritized properties that had at least 50% BIPOC renters or 50% of households, heads of household identifying as having a disability. And we also prioritized the buildings that were part of the Housing Bureau's North-Northeast strategy. With regard to the emergency household assistance, again, this was a partnership with over 34 community-based organizations, United Way, and then the Housing Bureau and its jurisdictional partners. And we have served over 25,000 individuals. And you can see the number breakout there between the Joint Office of Homeless Services, our CBO partners, and United Way. And we are in the final stages of wrapping up that program. We were on schedule to get all of the resources out the door by the end of the year to meet the federal timelines. But given the extension of the deadline, rather than have people working overtime in the holidays, we just extended that program into January so that folks didn't burn themselves out and not get to enjoy the holiday as best as possible during COVID times. And then finally, we have a homeownership assistance program. And this was to stabilize low-income homeowners, looking at trying to prevent foreclosure as well as avoid predatory purchasing. We worked primarily with our traditional affordable housing home ownership partners, which are all culturally specific, in order to help to stabilize people we have supported in the past, as well as other low-income homeowners. And again, our results look positive there, with 77% BIPOC communities assisted with both financial assistance as well as navigation services and counseling services to prevent foreclosure. Next slide, please. So some of the lessons we learned are fairly similar to the lessons that Kimberly mentioned with Prosper Portland. Because we are taking a systems approach and because we're working multi-jurisdictionally, we're blending sources of funds from the federal government, the state, and local government. And early direction on the use of funds and priority communities and program parameters is key to give all the jurisdictional partners enough time to coordinate the funding into a single program in order to maximize the efficiency and clarity, both for our community-based organizations that are working directly with people in need of services, as well as those participating for those services. We need to make sure that we can provide resources to community-based organizations who are administering the services and working directly with clients. It's a heavy lift because many of our community partners are also working with public health initiatives and other COVID response efforts, and they really need the staffing and the support in order to successfully reach the communities that the city of Portland is trying to prioritize. And you know, we need to make sure that we are understanding the needs of the households and how to administer the funds with due diligence and meeting state and federal requirements, but providing as much flexibility with as few barriers as possible in order to get the resources out efficiently to help support homeowners, renters, housing providers, and others in need of assistance. So with that, I believe I'm passing it off to Dan Eisenbeiss.
Good morning, Mayor, Commissioners.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Dan Eisenbeiss. I'm the Deputy Director of the Office of Government Relations. Thank you for the opportunity this morning to provide an overview of recent state and federal COVID-19 relief legislative actions. I will also provide more detail on the new federal emergency rent assistance program, as well as a look forward in terms of what we might anticipate at the federal level in particular, before I hand it back over to Matt Schaubold to discuss the current status and opportunities in the rental housing landscape. I will start by first, Mayor, acknowledging the discussion earlier about supporting the state and county efforts in vaccine distribution. That's something that we are very much engaged in those discussions and look forward to working with your office and others to help move the needle as much as possible on that front. Also want to say that like much of the amazing work that you've already been briefed on in terms of CARES Act Coronavirus Relief Fund implementation, the work of our office has been or was guided by development of a COVID-19 intergovernmental agenda that we worked with other city bureaus and council offices to develop in mid-April. That framework prioritized racial equity and providing support for the most vulnerable and impacted populations due to the pandemic and associated economic impacts. And that has been carried forward in the state and federal legislative agendas that council approved last week. Also want to thank our jurisdictional partners and the work of, in particular, our Portland area state and state legislative delegation and congressional delegation. So with that, I will turn to recent state legislation. As you know, the state legislature met in its third special session of 2020 on December 21st. They passed a handful of key bills related to COVID-19 relief, as well as allocated money to the Legislative Emergency Board, which met last Friday and made specific expenditure authorizations. Highlights include in the special session authorization for temporary sale of cocktails to go by restaurants and bars, as well as temporary limitations on third-party delivery fee charges to restaurants. The legislature via the emergency board last Friday also allocated $10 million for a small enterprise fund administered through the Oregon Community Foundation to provide micro grants to businesses. And they allocated $110 million for commercial rent relief that will be administered via Business Oregon. The emergency board also allocated an additional $30 million for the Oregon Worker Relief Fund. This is in addition to prior state contributions of $40 million to that fund. The city of Portland has previously also contributed $2 million to that fund that provides support for individuals who may not be able to qualify for state unemployment benefits. The emergency board also provided $6 million to the Quarantined Workers Fund that provides support for agricultural workers who may need to quarantine, as well as $14.4 million for employment-related daycare and continuance of state policies, and $9 million for grants of $1 million each for the nine federally recognized tribes in Oregon. The emergency board also provided $11.3 million for health equity grants, $5.1 million for behavioral health services, and the continued build out of an online portal for accessing those services, as well as $30.1 million for behavioral health clinics, and specifically 12 clinics around the state. The emergency board also allocated $1 million for the for a runaway and homeless youth program to provide support for the increased needs for youth who are experiencing homelessness. And in the special session, the legislature extended the statewide eviction moratorium through the end of June of 2021. And in conjunction with that, allocated $50 million for rent assistance through existing tenant-based programs, and $150 million for a new voluntary landlord compensation fund. The tenant-based rent assistance will be administered through the community action agencies that exist around the state. In our vicinity, Multnomah County is the community action agency. The voluntary landlord compensation fund will be administered via Oregon Housing and Community Services in conjunction with housing authorities. And I believe that Matt might speak in more detail to the implementation of those supports in his subsequent slides. The legislature also provided $135,000 to two community-based organizations to conduct proactive tenant education about the eviction moratorium and renter rights and responsibilities. And then last week, the legislature provided an initial authorization for Oregon and Housing Community Services to accept and expend $116 million from the Federal Emergency Rent Assistance Program through the Consolidated Appropriations Act that was passed at the end of December. Next slide, please. So as you will also recall, Congress finally took action after several months of on-again, off-again negotiations between the House and Senate and White House for an additional round of COVID-19 relief legislation. It was passed in conjunction with a federal spending authorization for the current fiscal year. The COVID-19 relief provisions amount to approximately $900 billion. It was signed on December 27th by the president. Key provisions include $284.4 billion for another round of PPP loans and forgivable loans, Paycheck Protection Program loans, as well as $20 billion for economic injury disaster loan and the advance program associated with those loans. Those are low interest loans to support businesses, as well as $15 billion for operators of live venues, movie theaters, and museums that have experienced at least a 25% reduction in operating revenues from an identical quarter in 2019. The bill also provides substantial resources for the public health response to COVID-19, including $22.4 billion for testing, contact tracing, and surveillance, $8.75 billion for vaccine distribution and administration, and $19.7 billion for vaccine manufacture and purchase. Most of those monies are routed through the CDC. There is also $4.25 billion for mental health and substance abuse support. And the bill provides economic assistance for individuals and households as well, including $166 billion for one-time direct cash assistance payments in the amount of $600 per individual or $1,200 per couple, as well as $600 per child for single filers of up to $75,000 in income, or joint filers of up to $150,000 in income before those amounts are phased downward. There was substantial debate around the size of those payments, and that's something that we anticipate will come back up as conversations about additional rounds of relief legislation come to the fore again. The legislation also extended enhanced unemployment benefits through the middle of March. That includes a supplemental $300 per week in payments for unemployment benefits. It also includes an extension of 11 additional weeks of unemployment benefits, so for a total of 50 weeks possible, including an extension of unemployment benefits for gig workers and self-employed individuals who traditionally have not been able to qualify for those benefits. The legislation provides $13 billion for enhanced SNAP benefits and $10 billion for childcare through the Child Care Development Block Grant Program. There's also $7 billion for broadband, including $3.2 billion for a new program that provides a subsidy for broadband service to qualifying households. It's administered through internet service providers, and internet service providers can also qualify for a reimbursement to help subsidize the provision of discounted internet accessible devices such as tablets and laptops to qualifying households. In the area of housing stability, the legislation extends the federal eviction moratorium until the end of January, which had initially been implemented via a CDC administrative rule. And the bill establishes a new low-income water and wastewater utility assistance program in the amount of $638 million nationally that will be allocated to the states, who will in turn sub-allocate that money directly to water and
Am I the only one frozen, or is he also frozen?
No, he's frozen.
Yeah.
Can you knock the turn off the video? Dan, can you turn off your video and just use your audio? You're cutting in and out. Turn off the video and see if that helps.
My apologies. Not is that better?
Problem. Yeah, much better. Thank you.
Okay. Though the legislation did not provide an additional round of flexible direct support for state and local governments in the manner of the CARES Act Coronavirus Relief Fund, it did extend the deadline for expenditure of those funds from December 30th of 2020 out by 1 year to December 31st of 2021. The bill, however, did provide $25 billion for establishment of a new emergency rent assistance program that will be distributed in the same manner as the funds were distributed to states and local governments for the Coronavirus Relief Fund. The new program will be specifically oriented toward support for households that need assistance with rent or possibly utility payments, and I'll speak in more detail in just a moment. The bill also had provisions providing additional support for schools and universities, as well as the Postal Service, and extension of payroll tax credits. Next slide, please. The new emergency rent assistance program will be distributed to states and local governments, as well as tribal governments, based on population calculations. There are minimum distributions to states as well. The US Treasury Department just released guidance late last night confirming their methodology for the distributions. Oregon will receive a maximum allocation of $281 million. That maximum allocation includes the amount that the state will receive, as well as any amounts that local governments receive. Local governments that have a population of 200,000 or more are eligible to submit a certification to receive a direct allocation. Under the CARES Act, the Coronavirus Relief Fund had allowed local governments with a population of 500,000 or more to be eligible for a direct allocation. So in Oregon, this means a number of counties will be eligible to submit for certification that were not previously eligible under the CARES Act. Portland has already submitted its certification. Hats off to the staff that have worked to make sure that that happens. Certifications are due to Treasury by midnight tonight. What you see here is estimated allocations for local governments. For the city of Portland, the estimated amount is approximately $19 million that the city will receive. You'll also see that Multnomah County is estimated to receive a little under $5 million. The way that the allocations work for local governments is that eligibility is based on total population in a city or county, but in cases of a nested city or and county, the actual allocation amount is first calculated for the city. And then if there is an eligible city receiving an allocation within an eligible county, the population of the city is subtracted from the population of the county before the allocation amount for the county is then calculated. The Emergency Rent Assistance Program can be used to provide support for rent and rent arrears, as well as utilities and home energy costs or arrears of those costs, as well as other housing expenses incurred due to the pandemic. 90% or more of the total funds need to be used for the aforementioned eligible uses. Up to 10% can be used for housing stability services, including case management or administrative fees. Eligible households include those that are at or below 80% area median income, include at least one person who has qualified for unemployment benefits or has an income reduction due to the pandemic, and includes at least one person at risk of homelessness or housing instability. The statute also specifies that priority shall be given to those households that are at or below 50% area median income and include a person who has experienced long-term unemployment of at least 90 days. In addition to that, Treasury has indicated that local governments will be able to add additional prioritization criteria when they design their programs. All of what I've said here is subject to forthcoming guidance from the U.S. Treasury Department. So a lot of these details are somewhat subject to refinement and confirmation. Looking forward, today is January 12th. As I mentioned, in mid-March, there will be an expiration of the enhanced and extended unemployment benefits. So that will be a key driver of discussions. We also know that the federal eviction moratorium is scheduled to end at the end of January. President-elect Biden has indicated that he will unveil a proposal for a COVID-19 relief and economic recovery package later this week. That will likely be in the trillions of dollars. His transition team has prioritized vaccine distribution and rollout. He has also indicated support for increased direct cash assistance payments at the $2,000 level that had been debated in late December. We will likely see a focus on continued unemployment benefits, small business relief, reopening schools, as well as a resumption of discussion about additional direct support for state, local, and tribal governments. That is something that House Democrats in particular had really prioritized, and it ran into opposition from Senate Republican leadership. As we know, in light of the Georgia runoff race results, the Senate will be split 50-50 moving forward, with the vice president casting the tiebreaker vote. That presents opportunity, although given that that is the absolute thinnest of margins, it also means that it'll take a lot of consensus building to move anything forward. We anticipate that there will likely be a prioritization of another relief package before turning toward a broader recovery package that might include more stimulus and infrastructure measures. With that, I'm happy to take any questions or open discussion before turning it back over to Matt.
Thank you. Colleagues, any questions at this point? Nope, that was very thorough. Thank you.
Matt, back to you.
Hello again. For the record, Matthew Schaubold with the Housing Bureau. Next slide, please. So I was asked to talk a little bit about what the impact of COVID-19 has been on renters, to the best of our knowledge. And so I wanted to share some aggregate figures with you. I want to thank the Community Alliance of Tenants and Multifamily Northwest and the Census Bureau and Portland State University. We've been working with all of those partners as well as others to collect rent non-payment data since about May of last year. In general, we've been seeing that rent non-payment has been holding on average between 12 and 15% per month since May. I do want to note we have seen some data that suggests that rent non-payment rate in the single family space could be upwards of 20 to 25%. We've also seen data that for Black renters in particular and Indigenous renters, the rates could be upwards of 30%. Across the marketplace, we are seeing about 12 to 15%. So what this means in terms of dollars is that given the number of renter households in Portland, which is about 125,000, we are seeing probably $20 to $25 million of rent arrears accumulating per month. I think one of the other data points I want to make sure that council is aware of is that what we have also heard through some research that has been done by the Community Alliance of Tenants and Portland State University is that for many renters, because housing is such a critical safety net, people are accumulating debt through payday loans and credit cards and other means in order to pay the rent first, leaving other bills to fall into arrears. While this is an accurate reflection of how much arrears is accumulating per month, that doesn't reflect how much debt households are taking on in order to continually make the rent payments as they can. So what this means through the end of 2020 is that since May, there is possibly between $160 to $200 million or more of rent arrears that has accumulated across the entire marketplace for renters and housing providers. Next slide, please. Now, so in general, when the Housing Bureau is looking at our work, we use a racial equity BIPOC focus, and that was only reinforced with the work that OEHR did and in terms of advising and guiding bureaus on how to respond to the COVID-19 pandemic, as I mentioned earlier. When you look at who rents in Portland, we can see that BIPOC communities, particularly the Black households and the Black community, rent at disproportionately high rates when compared to their white peers and the marketplace as a whole. Nearly three in four Black households rent, and it is close to 60 to 65% for most other communities of color. Next slide, please. Similarly, we know that BIPOC communities disproportionately earn below $60,000 per year. And we're using $60,000 per year as a marker because that is what our estimate is of what a household needs to earn in order to afford rent in the city of Portland. And that is with the assumption, the standard in the affordable housing world is that a household should not pay more than 30% of their income to rent. So in order to accomplish that in Portland, pre-COVID, households had to earn at least $60,000 per year to meet the average rent. So again, we see that BIPOC communities are disproportionately below that average, and thus disproportionately rent burdened or vulnerable to displacement or other economic disruptions. Next slide, please. So how does the rent arrears impact different communities? You know, I've mentioned a couple of data points and a couple of pieces of research that have come online since the pandemic started. We do not have great information. Comprehensive is probably a better word. We don't have comprehensive information on how rent arrears has accumulated differently for different communities. But we think that this is an important way to look at recovery and being able to pay down arrears and move forward. Given the disproportionate earnings of BIPOC households pre-COVID and the percent of pre-COVID income each would have to pay in order to pay rent. So how to read this is that prior to COVID, the average Indigenous household earned about $3,700 a month and had to pay 40% of that income to meet the city's average rent. And so what you can see here is if people are able to get reemployed quickly, and if people are able to get reemployed at their pre-COVID household income levels, and those are question marks at this point, that there is a disproportionate effect for how long someone would have to save 10% of their earnings in order to cover one missed rent payment. And it's quite substantial for many communities. And that is, again, a big assumption as to whether or not people are even able to save 10%, because we know that for a lot of renter households, all of their monthly income goes to their housing costs and food costs and healthcare costs, and so it's already a stretch. We are just using the 10% as for illustrative purposes, not to suggest that people can actually save 10% a month to cover past rent. Next slide, please. So I also was asked to give a little bit of an overview of the eviction moratoria and timelines. You know, Dan spoke to this a little bit. So in Oregon, the state of Oregon has adopted an eviction moratorium. I'm not going to talk about which House bill or which executive order, because in the end, they all reinforce each other. But through the various House bills and executive orders, there is an eviction moratorium in Oregon through December 31st of 2020. And the rent arrears that has accumulated is due on the 31st of March. House Bill 4401, however, state enabled protections that if a renter declares a financial hardship and submits a declaration to their landlord, then for most renters, not all, but for most renters, the moratorium will extend until June 30th, as well as the timeframe to repay arrears. So, that declaration is very important. And again, I want to emphasize there are certain situations that do not have this extended protections. In Multnomah County, there have been also a series of orders. In the city of Portland, through city council ordinances, has linked the city's regulations and the eviction moratoriums to the county orders. There have been a series of orders by Multnomah County Board of County Commissioners that established supplemental eviction protections after September 30th. And that was because coming up to September 30th, the state had yet to act. And so Chair Kefouri and Mayor Wheeler thought it important to put in place protections in the absence of a new gubernatorial executive order or legislative action. And what that did is it created a supplemental eviction moratorium beginning after September 30th to run through January 8th, which happened to be the timeline of the public health emergency when this was originally passed. And it provided a rent arrears period of 6 months after the end of the public health emergency. The board is set to actually take up rescinding this order on the 14th in order to try and reconcile eviction moratorium and timelines due to the passage of HB 4401 in December of last year. Next slide, please. And then finally, I was also asked to give just a brief overview of the State Landlord Compensation Fund.
Excuse me, Matthew. Could I ask you to go back to that last slide, please?
Sure. Sure thing, Commissioner.
So I'm curious. The one thing that is in Multnomah County's legislation is not a requirement that they have to sign a declaration. And I'm just wondering how accessible that declaration is and how are we letting the public know? So if the county removes its moratorium, then that means that most people will assume they have to pay their back arrears by March 31st.
Yeah, thank you for the question, Commissioner. So the declaration form itself is very prescriptive. HB 4401 was very prescriptive about the content and almost to a point the form of that declaration. And it is it also directed, I believe, the court system to post that declaration, as well as OHCS and many other state agencies, to post the declaration and to translate it into numerous languages. And I believe the languages were enumerated in the bill. We at the City of Portland will be taking that declaration and making it available through our communications materials at the Rental Services Office, as well as through our partner agencies, because we want to make sure that if the county does rescind their order, that renters know to get the added eviction protections and repayment period that they have to fill out the form. You know, I also think that landlords will be communicating that to renters because in order for a landlord to access the state's landlord compensation fund, they have to have completed declarations. So that's one of the conditions the state is putting on accessing the compensation fund. And so I imagine renters will also hear from their landlords about the forms as well. So then speaking to just briefly to the State Landlord Compensation Fund, the state is administering this compensation fund directly through Oregon Housing and Community Services, where they will intake applications. OHCS is still working to finalize the program rules, but in general, they're going to be prioritizing smaller landlords as well as landlords with a higher percent of units with rent arrears. Those seem to be the two criteria. And so after the OHCS takes in the applications and approves them, the housing authorities across Oregon and Home Forward here in Multnomah County will then make the payments because housing authorities already have payment infrastructures built up internally. But it really is administrative authority that the housing authorities have to collect the necessary financial paperwork and other documentation and make payments. And my understanding is that we anticipate $30 to $35 million here in Multnomah County, but that again is also still to be determined. And with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Like you preempted them all, Matt.
All right. Thank you, Matt. Looking ahead on this slide, I just wanted to take the opportunity to outline a few key decision points on our horizon. As part of this work session, I'm recommending that we get the local relief task force back together again, and perhaps for time and efficiency sake, right size it to a smaller core group of people for the ERAP funds. Similar to our process last year, after we received the Treasury guidance, the task force considered the requirements and made recommendations to council on how to allocate. I'm hoping to introduce an ordinance to appropriate these funds next month so we can quickly start programming the dollars and disperse to our partners. In a couple of weeks, Director Kennard will be leading a work session about city priorities, and this may lay the foundation of who should be part of the task force long term as we're navigating this pandemic and this economic crisis. And in addition, based on Dan's timeline of a potential new relief bill, we should start discussions on how to prioritize any additional funds that we receive as part of this new relief package that is hopefully coming our way. And you know, I hope that the city priorities work session will also be instrumental in informing the work that we're going to do around navigating and understanding how we should allocate funds as part of that. So. From what we've heard, we can expect that the Biden administration will act swiftly. I recommend that we're prepared to meet the opportunities that will be in front of us. And if council wants to gain a better understanding about current community need and strategies for relief and recovery, let's just start planning those listening sessions and work sessions right now. We should also tee up a team who will be dedicated to working on relief programs so staff aren't doing double duty for another 6 months as we're delivering new programs. I also wanted to take a moment to plant some seeds for future recovery funding. After we get on the other side of the pandemic, there's likely to be a bill focused on economic recovery, and much like the American Reinvestment and Recovery Act. According to a recent Forbes analysis, and you'll see that on the bottom of the screen, Portland already receives less funding per capita than other major American cities. And I believe there's an opportunity to move that needle upwards. If we take some time now to build a comprehensive one city approach that aligns with administration priorities, it could provide a clear platform for our Office of Government Relations and our delegation. And it also allow us to be opportunistic when funds do come available, and we'll be ready to apply for them as soon as we hear about new grant programs. I know some bureaus are already working on in the process of planning for recovery, but not every bureau is, and not everybody has the capacity. And so in a year where our budget position looks pretty challenging, working across bureaus now to position us for future funding feels pretty critical. And then lastly, you've heard our PDX CARES teams outline some lessons learned at the programmatic level, and you've heard about the state and federal relief funding coming our way. One of the big things that I hope for is better regional coordination of all relief funding. And to be clear, I'm really proud of the work that the city and our jurisdictional partners and our nonprofit partners accomplished as part of the CARES Act. But one of the few things that was challenging for me to see was the duplicative programming across jurisdictions. The city had a venues allocation, and so did the state. We had a household assistance card, and so did many others. We had business assistance program focused on restaurants, and so did the county. And so my hope is, as additional funding comes our way and we have more time to plan, we should continue to work with our jurisdictional and even maybe philanthropic partners to reimagine how we could take a more community-centric approach and coordinate our collective relief funds. Struggling Portlanders who are already under duress should not have to apply to two or four different sources to receive household or business assistance. We need to work together to leverage more flexible funding and less restrictive, flexible and less restrictive funds to reach those who do not meet the criteria for some of these programs. And as Matt alluded to earlier, there are the ERAP dollars and other funding sources have restrictions, especially for those who are at the risk of eviction. But we all know that many households will pay rent first and go without food or other household essentials just to keep a roof over their head. And is there a way we can work together to leverage more flexible funds to help these struggling Portlanders? I recommend that we do all we can to work together and ensure most of our vulnerable residents don't fall through these safety net cracks. So if there's one thing to focus on, I think it would be regional coordination, and this would be a very good opportunity to figure out how we can take that community-centric approach and really think about how we're going to make it easier for folks to access resources. And this concludes our presentation portion. Thank you, Mayor and Commissioners. I'd like to open it up for any other questions or for conversation. And if there are no questions, Tom will summarize our takeaways at the end.
No, there's questions. Commissioner Hardesty has one.
Thank you, Mayor, and thank all for a really informative presentation. To your last point, we need to know just how much duplication has taken place already so that we can avoid that in the future. So that's point one. And point two, the question is, who's still not being helped with these relief dollars? We still have people who won't have access to resources. What we've seen is that when we do gift cards, they disappear in such a quick period of time that clearly the need is significantly more than we're able to accomplish. So I am concerned that there are folks that get money from the city, the county, the state, and not saying that there may not be a reason why that makes sense. We don't know, and that's what worries me. We don't know. So how can we get good information as we start planning for what's possible in the future so that we're not in a position of trying to gather that information at the last minute?
Yeah, I would speak a little bit to that. We're still in the data gathering stages of our CARES program. So as part of the COVID-19 equity toolkit, we collected a lot of data in terms of who was being served. We're still analyzing that data right now, but that's going to be really instrumental in articulating who didn't get served this time around and how we can inform our future programs to serve those people that are falling through the safety net crack.
And when can we expect that?
Well, I would say that probably the month of February is going to be a good month for us to kind of get all the data that we have from both our jurisdictional partners and Portland Housing Bureau. They're still working on collecting and analyzing that data. So hopefully then.
That's fine. But I just know that we can't actually have an informed conversation without that data. So the data drives our planning, I would suspect, I would hope. Thank you. I mean,
and part of that is also making a decision if we do, if we do lead a conversation with our jurisdictional partners and perhaps philanthropic partners, we can identify who is gonna serve what group. Right. Are we gonna take the lead on housing and houseless response? Is the county gonna take the lead on economic assistance? I mean, these are all questions that we need to determine through a conversation. And I know that through my discussions with our jurisdictional partners with the county, there's a lot of interest in collaborating and, talking about how we can do this better the second time around. Should we get the opportunity and get money from the Biden administration?
Yes.
Great. Any other questions? And if not, we'll let these good people go about their days. Commissioner Mapps, hello.
Good morning, everybody. Sorry for the delay getting my mic on. First, I just want to thank everyone for the presentations that we saw this afternoon and all the great work that city employees have done to help our community recover from COVID. My question is, moving forward, how, especially into this new year, how often are we going to get updates on spending on COVID recovery efforts? Is this something that we can do on a more frequent basis? And I'll lay all my cards on the table. I think it would be helpful to my office, and I think it would be important for the public to have this information as quickly as possible. I'd love to see a dashboard that kind of summarizes our COVID recovery spending and efforts and whatnot. So if that's something that would be possible, I think that would be very helpful to my office, and I think it would mark a step towards even better government.
Thank you, Commissioner Mapps. I've already talked to your office about creating a dashboard for future funding. So for sure, there are pieces where we know now what we might want to collect in the future and report out on. And so our lessons learned from the CARES Act dollars, should we receive additional funding, we certainly could create a dashboard or some sort of tracking where we can do a spend down report. And, and if needed, we could pivot if programs aren't working or we need to do something different. But that's up top of our mind.
Great. Thank you so much.
Yep.
And Mayor, I have a couple closing comments if there are no other questions.
Commissioner Rubio had a
go ahead.
I think Commissioner Ryan had his hand up right before me.
Very good. Commissioner Ryan, then Commissioner Rubio.
Thank you. I just want to start off by really thanking this collaborative effort. And that starts with OMF and especially the finance team led by Sheila Craig. I've heard really good things. And Jan, Kim, that was just a great presentation. It was very dense. And so I think all of us are digesting a lot and might have more questions tomorrow. But I just wanted to start off by that. And also to Mayor Wheeler and Commissioner Hardesty, you were here when these intentions were set up and three of us weren't. And you know, we're just trying to learn about how we operated in an emergency. So I really just have two comments perhaps. One is I was heartened, and I think all of us are, by how the silos came down. And there was a lot of nimbleness among bureaus to, I would say, operate in a different way in this emergency. I think we have a lot of lessons learned from that that could be more of a standard operating procedure as opposed to just in an emergency. And Jan, I thought at the end when you mentioned, well, let me start by saying that I thought the lessons learned were good, but they were all positive for the most part. And I personally learn more when I talk about when I fail forward, you know, when you fall down and you get back up. And I can only imagine in this time of emergency, there were many stories like that. And I encourage us to connect with our partners and really listen to how we can be more efficient going forward. And I thought, Jian, you hinted about that when you talked about how we can be more efficient when in fact we are trying not to duplicate. And so that was a really good starting point. But as we align this with our priorities, let's just continue to look for those stories that will allow us to improve our efficiency. This is an all-in effort, and I'm excited to be a part of it. And thank you again for all this information. Thanks.
Thank you, Commissioner Rubio.
Thank you. I just want to say, or to echo my colleague's comments about appreciating this very comprehensive presentation. It was very, very helpful and useful for me in providing a lot of important context at a policy level. Having recently been on the receiving and implementation end last year, I want to also underscore and lift up appreciation for the wisdom to tap into existing community networks and community-based organizations that already have deep reach into community. And I think despite a lot of the confusion that last year presented, that was one way to swiftly get resources to where they needed to go in a very short and dense amount of time. Suggestion I would offer moving forward is, and I would fully support having those jurisdictional conversations sooner rather than later, so that this time moving forward, when we do tap into those networks of CBOs, the CBOs are not compressed for time. There was a mad dash to get that money and those resources out the door in a very compressed timeline. In part because, you know, of the coordination up front, it takes time to do that and to create a good system. So I'm all for supporting that and eager to support the planning that needs to take place on the city end. But thank you again, everyone. Excellent.
Very good. Colleagues, anything else for the good of the order here? All right. Thank you, everybody. Great presentation. Well done. Lots to follow up on.
Hey, Mayor, can I just make a couple comments to be clear on next steps? Thanks.
You bet.
So we're just to be clear with everybody, because there was a lot of information presented, GN will work with the council execs to right-size the local relief task force to allocate the federal rent assistance dollars and prepare for future funding. I heard Commissioner Mapps loud and clear on regular updates, and we will talk with all of the offices about the best way to do that. City leadership, we believe, and we think there is agreement, unless you tell us not to do this, we will work with you to convene a regional discussion on how to coordinate our relief programs so there's minimal overlap and maximum effectiveness. There's lots of ways to do that. So we will come up with some options. You know, you could delegate that to a person or a group, or, you know, mayor and council could work on that. We want to talk that through. Now, that obviously has some implications the way we approach it. And in preparation for new local relief funds, we really recommend that all of you think about an approach to listening to community partners to get an updated understanding of the needs. We believe that we have pretty strong data and indication of ongoing need, and that we won't be surprised by a lot of what we hear, but we do want to make sure that, we understand how you are doing that and how we can help you with that. And I want to build on Commissioner Ryan's comments that he's made in several meetings around, you know, we learned a lot through communication through this effort, but we think we can still improve as a city about how we coordinate and collaborate on all that together with your offices. And lastly, we heard some items from the mayor around arts and culture. We will follow up on that. I know Jeff and Rack were listening. I want to close out by just echoing, this was an amazing and really transformative effort for a lot of us in working together. Directors Branham, Callahan, Durbin, Kirby, Myers, Smith, Warner, all the teams that really stepped up. And for the folks that, within the organization and in the community that say that we can't act quickly, we can't make decisions quickly, and that we're unable to adjust and evolve, I think we put the lie to that. I think we show we can do that. And so let's continue to do that. And thank you to all the great work out there. We distributed over $100 million in response and relief programs in 6 short months, and we're going to be doing a whole other segment of that. And so let's continue to build on that spirit, and I just want to end with that. Thank you. Mayor, that's all I got.
All right. Thank you very much, Tom. Thank you, everybody. We are adjourned.